They sit there on the Adirondack chair, turtle in his lap, he holding her, and they watch the clouds come toward them in rows. The setting sun lights a corona of aquamarine and purple ocean. The sea stacks stand in near black outline. On their whitewashed shoulders, the cormorants wait with their wings outstretched to the setting sun. His biceps are more in span than her hands, thumb to pinky. The veins that cross them have more breadth than her fingertips. She hops off his knees and he rises and looks down at her and a spasm crosses his face. He drops to one knee and takes her into his arms. "Christ," he says. "Christ. Jesus Christ, Kibble, be careful. Christ, Kibble, Christ." He holds her, and she stands there, her waist encircled in his embrace. "How big you're getting," he says. "How strong. My absolute darling. My absolute darling." "Yes," she says.
"Just mine?"
"Just yours," she says. And he crushes the side of his face against her hips, presses it urgently to her, looks up at her. His arms encircle the small of her back.
"You promise?"
he says. "I promise," she says.
"No one else's."
"No one else's," she says. He breathes her scent in deeply, closes his eyes. She allows herself to be held by him. Because he hadn't found her, she'd thought he hadn't come looking. She had figured he had just waited for her to return to him. But now she stands, encircled by his arms, looking at his muddy boot prints and thinking, "You followed me, and you didn't find me." It has always seemed to her that he could find her anywhere, that he could anticipate her every move better than she herself could. She thinks, "It would have been better if you told me, Daddy, and we'd laughed about it. You could have made it a joke. You could have said, 'How tall and strong you are, how trackless your ways.'" She thinks, "You should have said something, rather than let me look at that mud and guess. Let me guess that you came after me and that you didn't catch me. And so you had to come back here and just wait." She thinks, "I would never have thought less of you if you had just shared that with me." Sometime in the night, she awakes and lies silent, chewing on the wadded up cotton of her sleeping bag. Then she rises and opens the window and steps up into the window frame, the moon shining on her naked limbs. She goes out the window and climbs down the rose canes, thick as knobby wrists, down into the muddy yard. And in the dark, she goes out into the weeds. The motion-activated lights come on with a click, and she lies there, breathing the wet scent of crushed radish and vanilla grass. The door to the master bedroom's mudroom opens, and Martin comes out and stands on the small master bedroom deck on the south side of the house, looking out over the field. He has a gun laid back over his shoulder. She can't tell which. With the spotlights shining down at her, he's nearly impossible to pick out on the deck, like a figure standing just to the right of the sun. He waits there, spread-legged and patient, and she can imagine his careful breathing as he looks out into the field. She buries her face, keeping the whites of her eyes in the grass, and she breathes, waiting for him, knowing that he will never see her. She thinks, there was something wrong with that story about that cat. He doesn't see things like they are, not clearly. Martin walks back inside. She hears the door slam closed. She exhales, raggedly, and slithers through the wild oats, searching with her fingertips until she finds what she's looking for. What she'd pitched discreetly out into the grass when she'd gotten out of the passenger side door. She finds it and puts it to her face and breathes into it. Then she returns, the motion-activated lights clicking back on. She crosses the intervening space quickly, lays the shirt over her shoulders to free her hands, and mounts up onto the wall. She climbs around a window and steps into the inside corner formed between the walls of the foyer and the second story, scrambles up the foyer's roof, and then climbs across the side of the building toward her window. She hears Martin's door slam open, hears Martin come out onto the south deck. He is hidden from her by the foyer. Above her, the bay window projects out away from the wall by 3 feet. She clings to the rose canes beside and below it, looking up at it and hearing Martin's footsteps. And then she vaults up and out. She grasps the windowsill and hangs one-handed, her feet in open air. She matches her other hand onto the windowsill and slips through it and muddily onto the floor. She holds the cotton scrap. Below her, Martin walks out into the yard. She peeks over her window, breathing hard. He stands beside the trash barrel, looking into the grass, and turns to look at the house. When he is gone, she relaxes against the wall. It's Jacob Lerner's t-shirt. It shows a candle in the center, and around the candle, a twist of barbed wire. Above that, an arc of stars. The shirt reads, Amnesty International. She sits chewing on her fingers, naked legs akimbo on the cold wood floor, scattered muddy prints of her heels. She plants her hands on the shirt. 9. Arriving from the raspberries, Turtle hears Rosie heave herself up and come to the door, shaking herself off and setting her collar to tinkling. Then Grandpa opens the door and looks down at her. Sweet pea, he says, would you give me a hand with this pizza? She leans the rifle against the jamb, pulls the pizza deftly out of the oven, and drops it onto a cutting board. She accepts a chef's knife from Grandpa, tests it with a thumb, and divides the pizza into slices. Oh, good, he says, watching the knife sticky with cheese. Oh, good. Grandpa, she says, you have to eat some other thing sometimes, not just these pizzas. Oh, it's fine, he says. It's fine. I'm long past worrying about my health, sweet pea. They move to the table. It's a rare thing, have you here for dinner, Grandpa says. He means it as a question. Yep, Turtle says. He sits with one hand on a bourbon glass filled with chilled soapstones. His jowls hang down and he looks like he is frowning. She unholsters the Sig Sauer, drops the magazine, locks back the slide and sets it on the table. It reeks of gunpowder. The exposed barrel is lathered with powder residue. The frame is smoked with it. Her fingertips black with it. Her trigger finger brassy. She shucks aside the card case, wraps the deck smartly, shuffles. Well, he says, tell me you didn't take that to school. I didn't take it to school, she says, then cuts, shuffles, deals. He collects his cards. They shake in his hand with a papery rattle. He says, the pines on the north side of the gulch have started to die, and on towards Albion, along the highway there at the bend, more of them are dying. It may be that pine beetle that everybody is talking about. I don't know what, sweet pea. Turtle discards into the crib. Those pines have been dead for a long time. Grandpa touches and sorts his cards with a trembling hand. It's getting on towards the end of the year, he says. She looks up at him. She doesn't know what he can mean. He sorts his cards. What was I? He says after a moment. I don't know. His eyes are yellow. He runs his tongue over his lips. Well, what was I saying? The pines, the end of the year, but it's not the end of the year, Grandpa.
Well, I know that, he says.
The game has stalled as he considers it. At last, he says,
the bees are dying. 6 hive sweet pea, and 5 of them dead.
She says nothing.
I don't know why, he scowls. Some mite, something. Maybe it's my fault.
It's not your fault, she says.
Maybe I, he gestures, forgot something.
You didn't forget anything.
6 hives, he says, and 5 of them dead. The larvae capped in their cells. The workers just don't come back. I don't know why. Must be something I did.
She waits for him to discard into the crib.
Can't think what it might have been. The end of the year. Isn't there a thing you do?
Grandpa, it's May.
A thing you do at the end of the year, he says.
I have no idea what you're on about, Turtle says.
Prom,
Grandpa says. Not prom, she says, because prom is high school. The dance is on May 16th, in less than 2 weeks. The last day of school is June 10th.
Well now,
Grandpa says and discards into the crib. Turtle cuts the deck. Grandpa draws the starter, a jack, and Turtle pegs 2 for his nibs. They are back on it now.
Well, he says. Well now.
He picks up his cards, throws an 8. Turtle throws a 7, pegs 2. Grandpa throws a 9, pegs 3 for the run of 7, 8, 9.
So will you go to the dance?
She laughs. He nods to the Sig Sauer, and the gesture is very like Martin.
I can't believe he lets you run around with this, he says.
Yeah? Turtle says.
I can't believe how that man is raising you.
He loves me, Turtle says. Grandpa shakes his head. He loves me very much, Turtle says.
Don't you do that, sweet pea.
What? Turtle says.
Don't be twisting things up like that. You can't be saying one for the other like that, sweet pea, so don't you start.
She cracks her knuckles, thinking, sorry, I'm sorry.
This is our town. This is your town. The people here are your people. And you're toting that thing around.
He fastens on his whiskey glass, his eyes becoming harder and harder, his aspect changing very little or not at all, but suggesting somehow a slow solidifying of his bitterness. He picks up a bottle of Tabasco and begins dashing it onto the pizza. Then he lifts a slice and holds it in trembling hands and sets it down. He picks his cards up and the game moves on in silence. She can see it in his face, how he can't get it straight, and how he sits there wishing he could. After a while, he says,
well, isn't there a boy?
There's no boy. Grandpa looks up at her now, and looks at her very searchingly.
How do you mean that?
There's no boy, that's all I mean.
Are things hard for you at school? Are you bullied?
No, she says.
That's good.
He pours himself more whiskey. They turn over the crib, peg out the scores, throw down cards and count them. Grandpa collects the cards with difficulty. He shuffles them. They play a hand. He pours more whiskey, looks at it. They lay down their cards, peg points for the crib. He says,
if you went, what would you wear?
I'm not going, she says.
I don't like to think that you wouldn't go.
Well, Grandpa, then I'll have to go to the dance.
Nah, he says. Is there a boy?
Sure, she says. Sure there's a boy. Grandpa's eyes are crinkled with his pleasure. He can't quit smiling. He sits raking his hand over his face, trying to quit because he knows that he looks like an idiot. And she can see he doesn't want to spoil it for her by looking like that. But he can't quit smiling, and so sits pretending not to smile and looks down into his whiskey with his eyes squinting with pleasure.
The little shit, Grandpa says.
You don't know him. He's very nice.
He's a little shit,
Grandpa says. He can't quit smiling into his whiskey. He rakes his hand down his face again. He quits the smile for a moment, and then it comes back with the left side of his face, and he turns the glass in its ring of condensation.
Well, you need a dress then, sweet pea.
No dress, she says, holding the split deck half in either hand. It feels like anything could happen. It feels as if the world could open up. Then Grandpa says,
He's never really laid into you, has he?
No, Turtle says.
Of course not, of course not.
He raises the glass, looks at the light slanting through the whiskey, drinks it down. He sets it on the table. He seems to have forgotten about the card game.
You ask him to go dress shopping.
A dress, she says, and laughs.
A dress. Here's what you say. Here's how you do this,
Grandpa says and nods.
He'll like that. You tell him, I want to go to the dance. He says whatever he says. Then you say, Daddy, take me dress shopping. Then you shut up about it. That's the end of it. And you never mention it again, and you let on like you've abandoned the idea until he takes you dress shopping. And then you don't say anything about the dance. And you don't say anything about any boy. All it is the dress. And it's you. And it's him. Then, when the dance comes, you just go. You don't ask to go. You just go. And you come back and you don't say nothing. And it's like the dance was between you and him. And there might never have been a boy at all.
Turtle shuffles the cards, deals, sits looking at the two hands. Neither Grandpa nor Turtle turns them over. She thinks,
the hell? That might even work.
But there isn't a boy and there won't be a dress. And then she thinks, you're forgetting what your life is, Turtle. And you can't forget that. And you have to stay close to what is real. Because if you ever get out of this, it will be because you paid attention and moved carefully and did everything well. Then she thinks, get out of this. Shit. Your mind is rotten and you cannot trust yourself and you do not even know what to believe except that you love him. And everything goes from there. They pick up their hands. Turtle's cards are no good. She'll wait and see what the start card gives her. But her cards themselves are no good. She might make something of them if she plays well. But when her cards are no good, it's always a game about regret. Because what she's put away in the crib, she may need. And there's no way to know in advance how that will go. But there's no way around it. She sits sorting through them to see if she can make anything of them, and wondering what the start card might give her. Grandpa sits, turning his whiskey slowly, the soapstones sounding against the glass. Turtle waits for him to play, and he does not play. That night when she walks out of the orchard into sight of the house, there is another truck parked in the driveway, and Wallace McPherson's orange VW bug. She squats in the grass and yokes the gun. She can see the shadows of the men around the table and she thinks, he will be in a mood. He will be in one for sure. She tears up red sorrel and sits chewing on the tart leaves. Then she rises and goes up the deck and in through the sliding glass door. Martin sits at the table with Wallace McPherson and Jim McLemore, beer bottles spread across the table, joints and cigars crushed into ashtrays, Martin dealing out poker hands. They look at her, and Martin brings his hands down on the table with a sound like a gunshot. "Well, there you are," he says.
"I was out with Grandpa," Turtle says.
"Out with Grandpa," Martin tells Wallace McPherson. "We were worried about her because she never came home, but as it turns out, she is only out with her grandpa. Her beloved, beloved grandpa. I shouldn't have worried. What harm can it possibly do to spend all your spare time with a remorseless psychopath? A man with no imagination huddled in a bleak, reeking trailer. A trailer filled with the stink of Jack Daniels and of his poisonous dreams. The wretched exhalations of a bitter, hateful little mind. Only spending time with dear old grandpa while he drinks himself to death."
Wallace McPherson looks at Turtle apologetically. His chair is tipped back on two legs. His black beard is groomed immaculately with waxed mustachios.
"Her dear old grandpa," Martin tells Wallace. "The gentlest of men, really. The kind of man anyone would want their daughter around."
He slaps the table again and looks at Turtle.
"What are you up to now?"
"Bed?"
"Bed? Well."
Jim McLemore says,
"That's an awful big gun for a little girl, isn't it?"
Turtle looks at him levelly.
"With a big... what kind of scope is that you've got there?"
Turtle doesn't see the point in telling him.
"Can you even fire that thing?"
She doesn't answer.
"Can you hit anything?"
She stands, jawing the sorrel.
"Well,"
and he shakes his head slowly.
"Maybe you can, maybe you can't."
Martin says nothing. Turtle walks quietly up to her room. She takes down her chest of tools and lays out a towel and sits cross-legged. She draws the Sig Sauer and drops the slide off the gun and sets it down in two pieces. She levers out the recoil guide rod. She takes a screwdriver from her tool chest and removes the polymer grips to expose the hammer strut and mainspring. Downstairs, she can hear Wallace get up and say,
"Well, I guess I'm heading home."
Then muttered an inaudible joking, laughter, the sound of Wallace putting on his coat, the swish and double kiss of the sliding glass door, and Wallace's footsteps down the stairs and into the grass, the ignition of the bug, and Wallace backing around in the driveway. Turtle stoops over her towel, levering at the gun pieces with powder black fingers. She ties her hair into a high, tight ponytail and goes on in a slow excavation of every cam and spring. She knows them all, and she lays them carefully out on the towel. Downstairs, she can hear Jim and her daddy talking. Their voices are muted and broken by long silences. She can't make out the words, but she can make out the tone well enough. She rises and walks down the hallway. She lies down on her belly and slithers out onto the landing, which doesn't have a railing, just a frame of cracked redwood boards, black with age and with oil. She crawls right up to this beam, lies with her cheek against it, and she listens.
"That girl of yours."
"Christ," Martin says.
"Ain't she a wild thing?"
"Christ," Martin says again.
"Looks just like her mother," Jim says.
"And nothing like me," Martin says.
Jim says,
"It's in the eyes."
There is a long pause as they both consider this. Then Jim says,
"Cold blue eyes, full of murder and vitriol."
He laughs at his own joke. Martin slaps the table, laughs. Both men fall silent. Turtle rolls onto her back, lies listening, looking at the ceiling.
Her mother said that it was a mountain lion that did it to her.
What? Another long silence. Turtle hears the chapped noise as Martin opens and closes his lips. Prefatory to speech, fails each time to speak. Then, with a laugh like a murmur, he says,
She used to say that she was asleep in the bedroom, and I was out cutting boards to repanel the bedroom upstairs. In the master bedroom, there's a mudroom and a porch beyond that. She says I'd left that door open. No shit.
Silence. Martin is perhaps nodding. Soft noises of his lips. A kind of click he makes with his tongue when he's thinking or lost in memories.
So she said that when she woke up, the mountain lion was in the bed with her, 8 feet long, head to haunch. Never seen a cat that big, Jim says. Not that I live out here like you guys. That's a big cat. She liked to rile you.
More silence, and then...
She said that the goddamn cat climbed on top of her and took her neck in his jaws and took her right there in the bed, from behind her. Said it had like a hook, like a spine on its cock.
Jim laughs, slapping the table.
Oh, fuck. She had some sass, didn't she?
Hilarious. Martin says dryly. There is another long silence. Then Jim says,
She's your daughter, all right, to her fucking bones. That girl is what? 110 pounds? All of it piss and vinegar and fucking murder. She's your daughter, all right.
Another long silence. And Martin says,
Christ.
You know, Jim says,
most often... I worry about girls growing up in this world, right? Right? It's not the same as with boys. What can happen? But with your daughter...
He collects the deck of cards with a papery rasping, knocks it against the edge of the table.
The thing about Julia, the thing about that girl, some asshole, right? You pity that fucking what he's about to find out.
Jim coughs out a laugh.
I don't think that's funny at all, Martin says.
I know, Jim says quickly.
It's fucks like you, Martin says very quietly. Fat fucks who have never seen a bad thing happen, that think that just being good is enough. But the truth is, Jim, it can go any way. And sometimes it just doesn't matter how good you are.
I know that, of course that's true, Jim says.
So it's not funny. I've done all I can for her, but she's just a 14-year-old girl, Jim.
I know, I'm sorry, Jim says.
You never know how a thing's going to go, Martin says. The outcome is just never certain.
Of course, I'm sorry, Marty.
And Christ... The worry keeps you up late at night. You just worry about what kind of world she's growing up into and what will become of her. Christ, it's an awful thing. And I wish it were like you say. But the truth is, it doesn't matter how tough you are.
She lies on the floor, listening to her daddy, his voice full of pain, looking up at the ceiling boards. They fit one to the other and go on. Board after board, across the ceiling, almost shrouded in darkness. And they are all of them miraculous in their strangeness and their particularity. And Turtle thinks, life is a strange thing. If you look around, if you look, you can almost lose yourself in it. And she thinks, stop. You were thinking like Martin. There is another long silence from below.
That was a fucking awful thing, Jim says after a moment. Christ, Martin says.
Hell, Marty, don't get on about her.
Christ, Martin says again. I could almost forget sometimes.
Don't get on about her. It's done. A noise as Martin shifts in his chair. The table creaks as he puts his forearms against it, perhaps leaning in. He says,
And you just have to think. What do you tell a girl? What do you tell her about the world? What do you tell her about life? What do you say?
Oh, fuck, Marty, I don't know.
The temperature may rise 6 degrees in the coming decades, and that's not just rising temperatures. That's a cataclysm. You think we can stop that? People don't believe in obesity, and that they can see in the fucking mirror. They can't take care of their own goddamn bodies. How many people die because their hearts are grimy with plaque, do you think? A lot. What is it? 70% of all Americans are overweight? Half of those are obese? And do you think, can this person, this average American, take care of anything? No. Fuck no. So the natural world, which they cannot see for all their roads and gas stations and schools and jails, the fucking natural world, which is more important and more beautiful than anything this average American has ever seen or understood in his whole fucking life, the natural world is going to die, and we're going to let it die, and there's no way we can save it. Fuck.
Optimism?
Optimism, hell, Martin says. You ask sometime. You ask somebody what they would do if the end came. You go ahead and ask them, and there will be among those you ask a population who will tell you that they would just die. And among those who didn't say it, more would mean it. People are content to live if the living should come easy. If it should stop being easy, well.
A silence. They sit for some time. And then Martin grating, his voice harsh and low, raking his fingernails across the wood grain.
Well, I tell you. What that question is asking is, what will you do when things get hard? And life will get hard. Life will get hard. And to say that you will not fight for it, well, what intercourse can you have with such people? There can be none. Their life is a sham of circumstance only. Their pretended agency is perfidy. A social lie. And to regard them as people is fetishism. So what optimism can there be? They will not fight for themselves. You think they will fight for a world outside themselves? A world troublesome to imagine, troublesome to understand. They have no language to understand it even. They see no beauty in it. And you know what the proof is? The end is coming. And here we all are, waiting with our dicks out in our hands.
Well, fuck, Marty. You know what I think?
She couldn't be fucking bothered. It got too fucking hard, and the headaches were too bad, and she gave up.
Don't get on about her, Jim says.
Why not?
You said yourself anything can happen. It could have been some random thing. It wasn't a thing she meant to happen. You know that.
Hell, I don't know shit.
Don't let's talk about her.
It's not a thing anyone can know, I guess, Martin says. But you've gotta fucking wonder.
It was an accident, and if it wasn't, I don't see that it matters.
It matters.
No, Marty, I don't think so.
You're a good guy for a cocksucker. You know that, Jim?
I'm not a cocksucker.
Being a self-hating Republican faggot doesn't make you any less of a faggot, Jim. It just makes you a faggot, and also a blind and self-deceiving motherfucker.
It's a wonder you don't have more friends. Turtle waits for more, but there is no more. and she crawls back down away from the landing and gets up and walks quietly into her bedroom, chewing on her fingers. She lies and looks at the square of moonlight cast by the window onto the floor. She thinks, "You don't know what you heard. You don't know. So don't. And you don't know what they meant. So don't. Turtle, just don't." 10. It is just barely dawn. Long, wet stalks of red fescue are bent over her. Turtle lies looking through the scope. Close into the gun, she can smell its grease and the powder residue. Around her, the meadow is dew-heavy, the mist purling down the hillside. As the day warms, long stalks weighted down with dew come suddenly untangled and spring up, their seed heads bouncing. There are yet no clouds in the sky except a single, distant lenticular, toyed into strands by the breeze. Turtle dials in her distance and lies, cheek welded to the stalk. The rifle target on its stand looks very far away. She thinks, "No way would I ever take this shot. No reason to do it. At 500 meters, you get up and walk away. I bet a lot of people think they can shoot out to 500 meters, and I bet there are very few that can. So just get up and walk away and take your chances. But," she thinks, "I guess you can't always." She dials the illumination down, the crosshairs going from laser red lines to black. She pulls the trigger. The gun kicks the hot shell into the grass. The target pangs and swings wildly on its hanger. Turtle grinning on the luck of that, of having doped out the shot on the first try. She fires again and the target pangs and swings and she waits for it to drop and she fires again and the target swings back up. Turtle smiling, the 308 shells nested, smoking in the wet grass. From behind her, chuckling laughter, she twists around. Martin is coming up through the field, his jeans wetted to his shins, holding a beer to his chest. He comes and lies down beside her. "Fuck," he says with slow pleasure, shaking his head, touching his dry lips speculatively, and looking at the thing from every angle, and ready to talk about it, but not talking about it. A moment when the things he has wanted have come to pass, and here, in company with them, all the doubts, all the work to get here, all the expense, and she can see the darkening of the moment. "Fuck," he says, looking away down the sweep of the hill, past the line of the sun to where the shining waves buckle and succeed onto the unseen shingle. "How did she die?" Turtle asks. He turns to her, his face bereft.
"How did she die?"
He shakes his head, inquiring mutely and wonderingly of her, of the moment, of the target downrange, touching the pad of his thumb to his lips.
"You don't know."
"How can you not know? I feel like I've told you this 100 times. 1,000 times. "No," she says.
"Fuck."
He stops, thinking about that.
"Really?
I've never heard."
"Fuck, there you go,"
he says, gesturing to indicate the futility of the thing. He bends down a green stalk, begins tearing out the spikelets, the hulls cleaving wetly to his fingertips. Finally, he says,
"Well, she went abalone diving, and she never came back."
"Really?" Turtle says.
"Right out there, Buckhorn Cove."
He nods down to the bus stop, the ocean, the sea stacks black, burged with breakwater.
"She went out alone early that morning. It was a beautiful day. The surf wasn't rough. Around noon, I went down to the beach and found her boat. I swam out to it. She was gone.
What happened to her? Martin probes his jaw. She just went down and never came back up?
That's right.
Could it have been a shark?
Could have been anything.
He drinks from his beer, tipping it up with difficulty from where he lies.
I'm sorry, Kibble. If it had to be one of us, it should have been me. I wish it had been me. She was everything I had. Well, not everything.
He rises and walks away. She puts her face in the grass. Then she struggles up and puts the spare magazine in her back pocket and follows him to the house. They climb up the porch steps together and he pitches his beer bottle out into the field. She goes to the fridge and takes out a Red Seal and tosses it underhand across the counter and he catches it and bangs it open on the counter's edge. She stands with the fridge door open, cracking eggs into her mouth, finishes the carton, discards it. They wait in silence. He offers her the beer. She drinks from it, coughs her mouth.
Time to go down?
You don't have to walk me.
I know, Kibble. I know that.
She nods. They walk down together. They wait at the gravel turnout. You don't have to wait here, Daddy.
Look at that big goddamn bitch of an ocean, Kibble.
The cormorants stand on the white-painted rocks with their wings spread, facing the sun. Spume lofts through the blowhole on Buckhorn Island.
It is all meaningless, he says.
And she does not know why it would mean anything, or why you would look for meaning in it. And she does not understand why you would want it to be anything other than what it is, or why you would want it to be about you. It is just there, and that has always been enough for her. The bus comes gasping around the corner and pulls into the gravel drive and throws open its rubber-skirted doors, and Martin salutes the bus driver with his beer, and Marjorie looks straight ahead at the road. Turtle walks down the green vinyl seats, and no one looks at her, and she does not look at anyone. She does not wait for the bus to go on to the middle school. Instead, Turtle stands up with the high schoolers and files out when the bus makes its first stop in town. She heads down the hill and out onto the headlands. She does not know where she is going, only that she can't go to school and nothing in her life is all right, and that she needs to get away and get her head straight. What she wants, more than anything, is to be lost again on the muddy slopes above the Albion. A jogger coming the other way stops in front of Turtle and props one hand on her knees and takes her sunglasses off with the other and then wipes sweat off her forehead with the back of her wrist. It's Anna, trying to get her breath, dressed in pink running shorts and a blue tank top, black hair gathered into a ponytail. She says, "Julia, what are you doing here?" Turtle says, "Oh, shit."
"Julia?"
Anna says again, in surprise. "Oh, fuck me," Turtle says. "Are you all right?" "What are you doing here?" Turtle says.
"I'm jogging," Anna says.
"But shouldn't you be at school?"
"Shouldn't you?"
Anna says. "I don't have class until 12:30, but you should be in Joan Carlson's math class right now. Am I right?" "Yeah," Turtle says. "What's wrong?" Anna says. "Nothing, I'm fine," Turtle says. "Are you all right?" Anna says, coming closer, looking at her carefully.
"One fucking time things could go well," Turtle says.
"What?"
"Why would I go to school?" Turtle says. "Why would I even go?"
"What?" Anna says.
"Why would I go? Have I passed a single one of your little fucked up, stupid motherfucking tests? You take me aside and you go after me like, 'Oh, Julia, why didn't you pass your test?' But isn't it fucking obvious why I didn't pass the test? What do you expect me to say? You're asking me to lie to you. I don't like to lie. I think there are good reasons not to lie. And I don't like that it asks that, your class. I need to get away. And of course, here you are,
Oh, why aren't you at school, Julia? Fuck you, you sideways bitch. I suck at school because I am useless, Anna. That's why. There's your answer.
She raises her hands in helplessness and lets them drop.
I have tried and tried and tried, and I fail. And that's all I will ever do.
Anna stands, still winded, her hands on her hips. Turtle can smell the other woman, a healthy, sweaty runner's scent, her tank top plastered to her wet stomach. She wipes at her face again, panting and seeming to think that over. She says, Julia, why do you think that?
Of course, Turtle says. Of course. Of course, that's what you'd say. I hate these questions. Why do I think that? Because it's true. It's so obviously true, so clearly true, that I don't understand why you would ask.
You only ask because you have nothing to contribute except open-ended questions, which isn't teaching, which doesn't help.
Why do I think that? I think that because it's true. You know it's true.
Do you really think that's true?
Oh, my fucking motherfucking shit-shitting God, Turtle says. What is wrong with you?
Anna blushes deep red. Even her ears go pink. She looks aside, off to the ocean, jaw open like someone struck. Stray hairs have escaped her tight, high ponytail, and points of water cling to their tips. She says,
Julia, that's fair. I messed that one up. You told me what you didn't like, and I went and did it.
The road runs from town, where they can see low white buildings with peaked wood shingle roofs and gingerbread weatherboard. Water towers burned brownish black with age. Opposite the town, an expanse of coastal prairie running out to coyote brush hedges, cypresses stooped and ragged. The ocean, sea stacks barren and carpeted with vast congregations of birds. Anna breathes deeply, doesn't seem to know what to say. Turtle watches her, feeling like she cannot exhale, her chest high and tight. She is ready for Anna to fuck this up, and Anna seems to be gathering herself and telling herself, don't fuck this up, Anna. Turtle thinks, I am screwed. I have said too much, and I am so fucked it's not even funny, and I ruined everything, and she's going to call CPS for sure.
Anna says, Julia, do you know what I think?
Turtle looks away, embarrassed, and Anna continues, blushing.
That was rhetorical. It wasn't a real question. What I mean, Julia, is that whatever you believe, I think is mistaken. There has been a miscommunication here. I watch you every day, and I know that you're smart. I know that you keep your thoughts to yourself, and you don't apply yourself to your work. And that's why you're struggling. But that doesn't mean you're stupid. It means that, in class at least, you're nervous and shy.
You don't know that. Turtle says, I suck at this. I suck at all of this. I can't do it. That's like saying I'm good at math, but just can't do math. I'm not smart, Anna.
If you could just show some spine in that classroom.
I have spine, Turtle says. That's not what I meant, Anna says quickly.
That was the wrong thing to say. Spine's not what I meant.
She looks around, rolling her eyes a little at herself. And Turtle looks at this in wonder, and she thinks, is she rolling her eyes because I am so frustrating and stupid? Or is she doing that because she wants this to go well, and she is embarrassed that she has made a mistake? Turtle doesn't know. Anna continues,
Julia, listen to me. You come to school, and you sit there and stare out the classroom window. You don't pay attention. You don't study. You don't have friends, and you don't feel safe, and you come to the first question on that test,
and you have this feeling of not knowing, and you don't push through it. You just stop there, and you think, I don't know it. And you sit there, hating yourself. That's what it looks like. That's my theory. But I think that half the time or more, you do know it. And you would know it even better if you studied. And you'd be able to fill out those tests if you push through that moment of fear. You tell me you've done your hardest and that you've tried. But that isn't true. She stops, knowing that she said the wrong thing. Turtle stands there, uncertain what to say. I'm sorry I said that. What I meant was that... I know what you meant, Turtle says. Well, I didn't mean to say that, Anna says. That came out wrong. I just mean, if you try, you can do this. You just need to throw some gumption at it. Is that what you think? You'll be good at it. Just try. I do try. No, you don't, Anna says, and then immediately bites her lip. Shoot, she says. I mean that... No, it's fine, Turtle says. It's not fine. I'm sorry, Julia. Jeez, this is not my day. What I meant is, you need to commit to it, and not be frustrated or alienated from it. Because I think you come to school, and you think you're bad at school, and so you are bad at school. But you're not bad at school. Anna reaches out impulsively and grabs Turtle's hands. Holding them, she says, just try. Just try. Okay, Turtle says. Anna lets go instinctively. Sorry, she says. It's okay. Sorry, Anna says again. I'm just not supposed to touch students. You're a bitch. Do you know that? Anna looks more hurt than Turtle could think possible. Her face closes, and Turtle is miserably sorry. Yeah, Anna says. Well, I like you a lot, Julia. Turtle says, can I ask you something? Anna walks over to one of the pressure-treated beams that line the road. She sits down. She puts her elbows on her knees. She looks out at the prairie. She says, what's that? Do you know if I can take a high schooler to the dance? What? Can I take a high schooler to the dance? Sure, Anna says. They have to be under 17, and you have to have parental permission. There's a boy I'd like to take to the dance, Turtle says. She reaches down, picks up a stalk of sour grass, sticks it in her mouth. It is tart and crisp and crunches audibly. Who's that? Is it just a paper my dad has to sign? Yes, Anna says. She watches Turtle very carefully. You think my dad hits me, Turtle says. I worry about you. You show a lot of classic signs. Watchfulness, isolation from peers, misogyny. What is misogyny? Hatred of women. He doesn't hit me, Turtle says. She watches Anna to see if Anna believes her. And herself, she believes it and cannot bear that there should be people out there in the world who could believe otherwise. Do you know that my mom died? Yes. She died, and I guess he never really got over it. Anna is staring at her. Turtle thinks, I cannot think of a time he ever hurt me. And she cannot. She thinks, and what was that with the knife? And she thinks, that was nothing. And the knife was nothing. It is just a knife, and it means nothing about care or about who you will grow up to be. I know how he is, Turtle says. He's still hurt. He hurts pretty badly, but he's never laid into me. Okay, Anna says. I know that you think he's hurt me, Turtle says. And it's hard to talk to you because I know you're thinking that. Turtle is thinking,
I don't know if my mother's death hurt me at all. She thinks, if it did, I cannot feel it, and I cannot feel the loss. I do not miss her, and I do not want her back, and I cannot feel anything about it, anything at all. And if I am hurt, it is because Martin hurt me. But I could almost believe that it's the tragedy and not his cruelty. Then she thinks, you are corrupting who you are, and once you start lying, you'll keep on lying. And you'll start seeing things out of convenience, and once you're there, it's hard to go back. That's what Grandpa always says. Maybe you get started twisting things around, you may never get them untwisted. Maybe it's like your hearing. It doesn't come back, and each day there is less of you. Anna is looking at Turtle very closely now, and Turtle can tell that it's almost as if she is telling the truth and that Anna does not quite know what to say. Anna is good at looking at a girl engaging, but Turtle has it all almost out of her mind, and it's like it's true, and the truth of it is surprising to Anna. The truth and the way she's put it. Oh, Julia, I'm so sorry to hear that. That must be terribly hard. I thought you should know. Julia, you're amazing. Turtle says nothing. Anna says, you're very unusual, do you know that? You have an unusual mind. Okay, Julia, that is fair. That is fair. And that would be upsetting to have someone be suspicious. You are so incredibly smart. I can see that you love your father, and it would be upsetting for anyone to have those suspicions. And I want you to be able to talk to me, and I want to be able to be your teacher. So I hear you, that your father is grief-stricken, and that things are hard at home, but that there's no wrongdoing. I hear you. And I respect that. But let me say this. No. Let me say this, Anna says. Don't. If it ever goes badly, I will be there for you. You call me or you show up any time of the day or night. You give me a call from anywhere. I will come and pick you up. No questions asked, all right? And you can stay with me for as long as you need to. And I won't even ask until you start talking, okay? You're not listening, Turtle says. That will never happen. I hope not, Anna says. But I will be there. You hear me, don't you? I hear you, Turtle says. Do you hear me? I hear you, and I believe you're telling the truth. But if for some reason you were lying to me, if you felt like you had to lie to me, you wouldn't need to be embarrassed. You could still call me, and I'd never think less of you. Turtle thinks, you suspicious bitch. That's true, what I told you. That's all true. Even I believe that it's true. And thinking this, she smiles at Anna. Can feel herself smiling affectionately, as she always feels affection for people who are difficult for her, smiling and cracking her knuckles. And Anna says again, I hear you. She leaves it at that for a moment, and then she looks askance at Turtle again, and she says, day or night, and I will make it happen for you, Julia. Turtle sits there, hating the other woman, thinking, you bitch, but smiling, self-conscious of this ugly expression on her own lean bitch face. Anna says, you want to ride to school? Turtle looks around, embarrassed. Yes, she says. They walk back down the road in near silence. It is windy, and the grass and coyote brush lie this way and that in the blusters. Anna's car is a blue Saturn with a kayak rack and kayak on top, the passenger side view mirror duct taped in place. There is a great blue heron standing on the hood of the car, better than 4 feet tall, blue-gray with a shaggy chest and clean, slat-feathered wings. When it sees them,
It takes to the air, rising up and flying along the headlands. Anna gets in first, does something to unlock Turtle's door, and Turtle has to lift up a colander of purple green.